Hello and welcome to this premium directors series that we're doing on the Lotus Eaters. I'm Harry, joined again by Josh.
Hello.
And returning guest from the Kubrick series, we have Chloe from Proper Horror Show. How are you doing?
Hi, Fex. It's lovely to be back. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. So this was something that we were thinking about while we were doing the Kubrick series, as if we were really enjoying those discussions. The audience were enjoying them as well. So who would we follow on with? And we thought it was only appropriate to cover a director that we're all very fond of, that being David Lynch. I know the most obvious thing for me, David Lynch is my favorite director. So it was no surprises for having guessed who it was going to be. But this series is going to be quite similar to the first one, where we're going to talk about his entire filmography, mainly his feature films that he produced, because David Lynch is a lot more than just his feature film series, where there was a lot of adverts that he produced, a lot of artwork that he produced as well. As far as I can tell, Chloe's going to be filling in some of the details on that for us, because I've not explored that part of his creative output anywhere near as much. He also was a musician who'd released quite a bit of music.
But didn't know that.
Yeah,
I've already learned something. The video's hardly started yet.
Yeah, he wrote the sort of music that you would expect him to.
Of course he did, yeah.
Yeah, old rock and roll style stuff, and also industrial. The guy,
he's a fan of Nine Inch Nails, isn't he? So I can see that.
He got them to guest in The Return.
He did, yeah.
Although you've not got to that part yet,
no.
So we'll leave that as is. So as we go through the films, we'll do our best to analyse them, fill in a lot of the details of them. And of course, there will be major spoilers for each of these films. Not that I do think in the same way that you can spoil a Stanley Kubrick narrative, you can't really spoil some of David Lynch's more esoteric works, because they're very experiential. They're the kind of films that you have to feel through yourself, which is part of the enjoyment of them. But if you are worried about basic narrative plot details as you go through, we'll let you know when we start talking about a particular film that we're going to, and we'll try and get the editors to put up a timestamp so that you can skip ahead if you would like. First, though, obviously everybody knows my feelings on David Lynch, so let's start with you two. What's your general overview of Lynch's work that you've watched so far? Because I don't think any of us have yet watched all of his work. Ironically enough, despite him being my favourite film director, I've not yet watched Straight Story, which I will be watching in the process of doing this.
So I will give you some more time to think, Chloe. I suppose I'll be quite brief. If David Lynch just made Twin Peaks, I would still think he was a great director. The fact he's done other stuff is just an added bonus in my mind. Twin Peaks holds a very special place in my heart. It's such a wholesome, in places, series. But there's something about it. It's got a soul much more so than a lot of things. And some of his films, I might upset Harry a little bit, are a bit hit and miss with me. There are some that I thought were excellent. There are some that I feel like I either went over my head, or I didn't get the point, which I'll get onto. Is an unusual way of looking at the films. But he's certainly a filmmaker that will make you think about what you've watched, which, as far as films go, is all you can really ask for. You know, if you're watching a piece of cinema, you want to go away and actually have to think about what you've watched rather than have it spoon-fed to you. And if you like that sort of thing, which I think most people who watch films and are actually interested in cinema, they're very much interested in that approach to things. And so there's always something to think about. There's always a way of analysing it. And it's always fun to do so. So I feel like that's my thoughts on Lynch.
Wonderful. Chloe?
Oh, excellently said. I mean, Lynch is a great follow-on from Kubrick, because both of them are making films that they refuse to elaborate on. They will not explain. But I think for different reasons. Well, in the case of Lynch, I totally agree with you. He wants people to think, and maybe even more to feel. Like there's
very much so, yeah.
There's a phrase that Kubrick used called the tyranny of the verbal, which was his way of expressing, like, if I spell it out for you, I reduce it down. I don't want to spell it out for you. I want you to think. And Lynch has this idea of the way he talks about catching the big fish, getting the great idea, is almost like he wants the idea to come to you. And the second he puts it in words, he's chopping bits off the idea. He's breaking it down into this really narrow form. And he doesn't want to do that, which is why the films are such an experience of imagery and symbol and implication. And I've looked at him before, but I feel like it's only after seeing some other analyses that I worked out how to look at him. And it's just meant that I see the films in a very different way now. It's been great sort of enjoying one level of them and then trying to feel around for what else might be going on there. So we might have completely different takes on these films as we go, but that's, I think, the joy of David Lynch's stuff.
Yeah, that's part of the point. Mm-hmm. From what you're both describing, I agree completely. When you approach a Lynch film, you get this wide variety, this vast expanse of different paths mm-hmm. that you can go down in analysing it and trying to figure out what it means, what he meant, and most importantly, what it means to you. I think that's the most important thing that Lynch wanted from his films, is for you to have your own personal experience with it. So if he were to explain exactly what he was thinking the entire way through, it closes off all of those other paths and leads you down that one narrow path, which is much, much less interesting. And amongst that as well, there are different layers of interpretation and puzzle solving that you can go through as well, which is his films always have a baseline narrative that you can follow. And there is sometimes the mystery of what's going on in the narrative. There are ones that are a bit simpler, like Blue Velvet, where the narrative itself is very straightforward. And then there are the ones where it's a bit more complicated, like his LA trilogy, particularly Inland Empire, which I'm very interested to see what you two make of that when we get to it. But above that pure narrative interpretation, there are all of the other abstractions that you can take from it as well, where it takes on perhaps more of a symbolic meaning, a more archetypal meaning with some of these characters, and as well as that, a more metaphysical reading that you can take from all of it. And I think that's all intentional, all supposed to be read into, but he doesn't want to guide you down the path. He wants you to choose your own. It's like a choose your own adventure sort of thing. So that was something that attracted me to him. I just remember the first time I watched Blue Velvet, which I finally watched after my dad had told me for years how good it was during lockdown. And the first thing that captured me was the feeling that no other filmmaker had been able to give me, which was this feeling of both incredible lightness, wholesomeness in some parts of the film, and the dread and experiential darkness of other parts of it. And I'd never found that in any other filmmaker and wanted to recapture that. So I went through the rest of his films and have still not been able to find any other director that did it. But I think what's also unique about him is it's a kind of feeling that can only be captured through cinema. Given that he'd experimented with all of these different mediums for expressing himself, I think he had a good understanding of how to use each as it should be used. In the same way that Kubrick is a filmmaker whose stories could only be told through film and cinema and the techniques and artistry that comes with that. So I think that's something unique that they both share together, and why you can draw so many parallels between
them. Comparing Kubrick and Lynch, I think, is actually quite good in understanding both of them respectively, in that I think, not to say that they don't have considerable overlap in terms of themes, but I think Kubrick is more concerned with sort of the realm of ideas. He's a bit more analytical, perhaps. Not to say that Lynch isn't, but that's sort of how I think Kubrick thinks about his films, whereas Lynch, I think, is far more concerned with expressing emotions in the viewer and giving you a very well crafted atmospheric experience. And of course, films like The Shining, which Kubrick masterfully directed, certainly has an atmosphere, but they have a very different feeling, both each of their films, don't they? And I think that particularly the way in which Lynch approaches duality, in that he has both light and dark expressed in some of their most extreme ways and contrasted next to each other, the feelings that he evokes in his films are very unique. It sort of makes him very distinct from a lot of other directors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. See, I would say Kubrick is actually one of the only other filmmakers who's come close to capturing that same kind of
they are quite similar, atmosphere aren't they?
As Lynch, particularly in films like Full Metal Jacket. Because in Full Metal Jacket and some of his more satirical pieces, he has a similar feeling of the absurd that you get as Lynch, where there are these utterly depraved, monstrous characters in it, but they are so over the top, so evil, in a way that still feels true to life, that it becomes a bit absurd in and of itself. Because there are horrible, awful people, but there's also something laughable and something pitiable about them, which I think is captured in both of their works. Because really, I think both of them capture this idea that the evil is corruption, evil is monstrous, but also evil is pathetic most of the time. Most of the time, it's pathetic people, and that's something that we'll get onto when we get further into his catalogue, which is that all of Lynch's big villains tend to share particular defining characteristics with one another, that being that they are insane sexual degenerates. And what he meant by this, I think we'll discuss as we go on. But first, let's actually get into his filmography and some of the time before his filmography with Eraserhead, his first debut feature film that came out in 1977, was 5 years in the making, I believe, because he kept running out of money and was very much a passion project. And really, rewatching it for the first time in ages for this series, it was remarkable to me how much of his vision was fully formed from that very first feature. So many of his calling cards and tropes that he would employ, some of the absurdist humour, the use of camera movement to create a ghostly atmosphere, the sound design, the characters themselves being strange and off-putting, but also kind of real in the awkward way that they all speak to one another. So much of it felt like a mission statement, fully formed for the rest of his career. So, Chloe, you've been doing the reading. You've got all of these wonderful books. You've managed to track down a very difficult to get hold of book here of his artwork. You've got Room to Dream. Josh has got quite a few other works. I assume you've read each of these cover to cover, correct?
Oh, every page, definitely. No. Yeah. I mean, some of these books, bless them. I'm not saying they're all worthless, but I have brought some of the modern film criticism, and I will be giving people a little sample of it for exactly why we're not going to use much. In fact, shall I just inflict it on some people right now?
Why not?
Let's give people a treat.
No better time than the present.
Let's give people a treat. This is the world of film criticism, right?
And who's the author of this?
So this is from Mike Miley, David Lynch's American Dreamscape. This is a fairly recent compilation of film criticism articles about him focusing on the music in particular, which I thought was quite nice. And, oh, how cancerous do you want it?
I'll just inject it straight into my veins. Microwave me.
Oh, okay. How about further the cover songs on page 147 for about a paragraph?
And this is about Lost Highway. Mm. So will this spoil much of Lost Highway for right now?
Or no.
Okay.
There is a very good point about in a film where, I suppose this is a minor spoiler, let's say where people's identities are fluid, let's say.
Up in the air,
which is, to keep non-spoiler.
Which is also basically a recurring theme of his work from Twin Peaks onwards.
Yeah, there's a really good point that a lot of the music in there is cover versions. So one song you expect to be done by one person is taken over by someone else. I thought that's a really interesting point.
And then you get to this.
Toxic masculinity turns up.
Oh, no. Further, the cover songs in Lost Highway reveal how these notions of desire and agency in rock music and cinema have been coded to satisfy and maintain a patriarchal order. The film's visuals indulge heavily in macho rockist iconography, particularly in its fixation with cars, pornography, pin-up fashion, and most of all, aggressive and aggressively whitened male rock music. The visual iconography partners with the sonic abrasiveness of the covers to suggest that what Martha Nickumson calls the mid-century cultural fantasies about family love and male identity have, like Fred Madison, Bill Pullman's character, undergone painful transformations and become caustic, manic, and violent. By the end of the film, Lynch's covers and their affiliating misidentifications fulfill Kasabian's claim that compilation scores challenge dominant ideologies.
Hmm.
Such as patriarchal authority by preventing viewers from being tightly tracked into identification with a single subject position, even if the film does this by cultivating discomfort. Now, I think the point of him using particular covers of songs to highlight the wayward identities and the fluid identities of the characters, that's interesting. That's an interesting point and probably something that he thought about. The rest of it, I hate to break it to you, I think David Lynch just actually really liked all of those things that are featured in most of his films, like cars, coffee, smoking, beautiful women. I think this is a case of reading a little bit too far into it, reading your own ideology out of the text, because this has been remarked on by quite a few people who knew Lynch. Those things that keep featuring in his films, like White Picket Fences, Small Town America, everything else I just listed, he just genuinely loved them.
Like on the Small Town America point, Lynch talks about his childhood as being like perfect and idyllic and how he had such a lovely upbringing. So he's not going to look at White Picket Fences and say, yeah, this is terrible. This is coming up because it's a soft spot for him, right?
Mm, and absolutely.
Were anyone to make a film, you present things that are important to you, obviously. You wouldn't present things that are insignificant.
And Lynch also... this is an argument I got into with people online when he passed away earlier on this year, where people were trying to make the argument that all of his work was violently anti-patriarchal because of characters like... Minor spoiler here... but we've already talked about Twin Peaks in a separate video, so hopefully you should be familiar with it, because of characters like Leyland Palmer and what he does in that series. And one example does not prove that all of his work was patriarchal. There is a definite theme in all of his work of women in danger. That was literally the tagline for Inland Empire, A Woman in Danger. And it's an apt description of most of his work. But most of the time, those women in danger in his films are not saved by being girl bosses. They're saved by being sweet, kind, feminine, and being protected by a dominant, charismatic, wholesome man. That's typically what happens. So if you're going to say that that's patriarchal, anti-patriarchal, I think that's, again, people reading their own ideology into it, when really what he's showing is the two sides of the coin. As with everything, there's the duality of masculinity corrupted in Leyland Palmer and a positive masculinity in somebody like Agent Cooper.
I think many of Lynch's characters actually pose a very detailed and nuanced view of different sex roles, but in a quite wholesome and positive way. Like Lynch doesn't seem to be casting judgment on either one necessarily. He's you know, directing his camera lens to both.
Yeah.
The human condition more generally.
Something he's very specifically said and raised through repeated use of duality is just the idea that we have these depths to us. Like he said, Frank Booth is in all of us. So the villainous, depraved antagonist of Blue Velvet.
Maniac.
He's like, Frank is in all of us. And, you know, We're not just sort of one thing, and he wants to be able to express all these facets.
That's part of the point of the character arc that Jeffrey, that's the main character in Blue Velvet, right? That's part of the character arc that Jeffrey goes through in that, is finding that he has a bit of Frank in himself and having to overcome that and destroy the external Frank to tame the internal Frank within him. Again, spoilers.
Sorry, I'd love to tame the internal Frank.
I mean, we all have to.
If you'd like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.